Now. Now your ideas don't have to wait. Now they have everything they need to come to life. Dell Technologies and Intel are creating technology that loves ideas, loves expanding your business, evolving your passions. We push what technology can do, so great ideas can happen right now. Find out how to bring your ideas to life at Dell.com. Welcome to Now.
Thirty-five days for this.
If we don't get a fair deal from Congress, the government will either shut down on February 15th again, or I will use the powers afforded to me under the laws and the Constitution of the United States to address this emergency.
Happy Valentine's Day. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Friday, today, the 25th of January. Good as always to have you along, everybody. So, 35 days, a month and a bit, and now 3 weeks, which is, in case you're counting, 2 weeks shorter than the shutdown to figure out a way not to shut the government down again. Congress and the White House obviously made a deal this afternoon, 3 weeks of no shutdown while they talk about border security. Not mentioned, other than by the president, was any money for a wall. We will start there and see where things go as we talk about the week that was. Catherine Rempel is at the Washington Post. Gina Smilek is at Bloomberg. They are both in our studios in New York. Hey, everybody.
Hey, Kai.
So, Catherine, let me start with you and ask you this. We have arrived basically, I think, where we started, which was the president threatening to shut down the government. At what cost? What cost have we brought on ourselves?
I think there's a tremendous cost, both to the families who were directly hit by the shutdown. That's 800,000 people who were not able to pay their bills for the last 30-some-odd days, of course, and the ancillary jobs that are not directly on government payrolls, of course, but like government contractors, rest stops that are nearby parks that were shut down, whatever else. So there are those costs there. Then there are lots of other costs, including the confidence that we will ever again have a functional government, or the attractiveness of working for the civil service. So I think that there are a lot of longer term sources of damage that we may see that are not quite obvious to us yet, but that have to do with confidence in our system of government and the security of those kinds of jobs.
Gina, what do you think? I mean, there are lasting effects, right? Just to give you a whack at that question.
Yeah, absolutely. I think what Catherine just said about security and government jobs is important. And it's important when you think about sort of the vital function some of those jobs perform, whether that is parsing our economic data or, you know, informing us on weather trends. And I also think it's important to note that consumer confidence took a real hit from this.
Yeah, totally true. Catherine, let me ask you this. Think back to this morning and also yesterday. Secretary of Commerce Wilbur Ross goes on CNBC and says, I don't understand why they can't get loans. Larry Kudlow, the president's chief economic advisor, says, oh, they're basically volunteering all those furloughed workers. So we had that. And then this morning we had the air traffic control mess at LaGuardia Airport. Do you suppose that brought things into focus for the president?
I think that those very well could have contributed to his breaking point on this. If you also look at his approval ratings, they have been dwindling. They were not particularly high to begin with, but they were, you know, not totally embarrassing. Yeah. So his approval ratings had taken a hit, coupled with these tone-deaf statements, lots of sympathetic stories of struggling workers and their families, you know, all over TV and radio over the last few weeks, plus the air travel delays, plus, of course, something totally unrelated to the shutdown, the arrest of Roger Stone, and potentially looking for something that was a I don't know if I would say a feel-good story, but a better-feeling story.
A distractor, right? I mean, that's kind of what it does.
Right.
Yeah.
Exactly. So I think all of those things could very well have gone into his thinking to finally say, you know what, let's take a pause on the pause and get the government running for a little while again.
Gina, let me ask you this. As we let's lift our noses out of the shutdown here for a minute and look elsewhere in this economy, right? We still have trade wars going on. The China thing is unsettled. Tariffs are still happening. And the Federal Reserve meets next week talking about interest rates and the state of this economy. There are other things happening now that are going to start to get some more attention.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think for the Fed, though, the fact that this government standoff is still hanging in front of their faces in the near future, I think that is going to be important, especially when you couple it with, like you mentioned, the fact that we're still in these trade wars. Global growth is still showing every signs of slowing, even if it's not apocalyptic. It's certainly cooling off a little bit. You know, they've got a lot of cross currents to work with. At the same time, they're seeing really low unemployment and some wage growth that could, according to their models, spur higher inflation, though we haven't seen much of that yet.
One never knows. All right. One of the things that I've been thinking about during this shutdown, and we're going to do a little in the rest of the program as well, is the way we measure this economy, government data that we haven't been getting. And I want in the next minute, actually, for each of you to tell me your favorite data indicator that we haven't gotten that you've been missing. Catherine?
Oh, there are so many to choose from. I mean, we don't have the budget numbers. We don't have housing starts, new home sales, lots of things. I think the one that I am missing the most amidst this trade war is the trade data. We still don't even have data for November that was supposed to have come out a couple of weeks ago, I think, at this point. And so it's really hard to gauge how the various points in the supply chain are handling all of this uncertainty about whether they're going to have access to markets abroad and whether they can continue getting their supplies from abroad as well.
Gina, your turn.
We haven't missed it yet, but PCE inflation is likely to be delayed
now,
given.
Stop showing off. What is that? PCE inflation.
PCE inflation is the Commerce Department's inflation gauge, and it's the one the Fed really cares about. Right. It's likely to be delayed because the folks who collect it have been off of work, basically.
Yeah.
And it's really important figuring out what they're going to do next. And so I think that's the one that I'm really focused on, and it will be. Hopefully, they're still working February 15th and we still get it.
Oh, man. Well, back to work anyway. Who knows? Gina Smilek at Bloomberg and Catherine Rempel at The Washington Post. Thanks, you two.
Thanks, Guy. Thank you.
Have a nice weekend. So, as you heard, I was asking those two about the data they have been missing during the shutdown. And we're going to run with that idea for a while, as I said, because the list of ways in which the government measures this economy is long. And it's been missed. Everything, and I'm going to give you the actual data professional names here, everything from the value of construction put in place, that is construction spending, to today's incredibly relevant information given the air traffic control snafu this morning on flight delays and mishandled baggage, that is technically the air travel consumer report. There's the advanced monthly retail trade report, retail sales in the vernacular, of special interest to Jack Kleinhans. He's the chief economist at the National Retail Federation, who is lamenting not having the December numbers.
And it would be important for us to have that information because the holiday season is probably the most important spending period during the whole year.
And we should be clear here that now that there is a deal to get the government opened up, the Census Bureau, which provides that retail sales number, is going to get back to work. But that does not mean the numbers are just going to appear on Monday morning.
Now it's going on, 35 days? We're almost into 2 months of data that could be backlogged. So it might take a while for the federal workers, our statisticians, et cetera, who process this data. It could actually take a good month or longer at this point before we would get data from 2 months ago.
Not to belabor the point here, but there are economic costs to not getting this data when we were supposed to get it. Another real-world example, also from our friends at the Census Bureau, new home sales, or officially new residential sales. Amy Scott, on our housing beat, promises she is not the only one who's waiting for that report that we didn't get today.
Who cares how many new houses sold last month and the month before? Yes, economists and analysts whose job it is to follow the market and predict where it's headed, but also real estate agents and developers, home builders, city planners, and investors. As one economist told me, all these folks have been increasingly flying blind when trying to make investment decisions. Housing also tells us a lot about the overall economy. It makes up around 15% of GDP. And gaps, not just in reporting the data, but collecting it, could make it hard to catch up. There are private surveys analysts can turn to, and we're still getting existing home sales, which fell sharply last month from the National Association of Realtors. But with its large national surveys, there's no perfect substitute for census data. And for people who count on those numbers, today's deal couldn't come soon enough.
Marketplace's Amy Scott, she covers housing for us. A couple more examples of the economic consequences of missing government data a bit later on in the program. On Wall Street on this government opening Friday, you know, what's really interesting is how little attention traders have been paying to Washington the past 35 days. We will have the details when we do the numbers. We bring to a close today our series of peeks inside the economic mind of Donald Trump, our top 10 list of ways the president has changed or tried to change the way we talk about the economy in this country. Here with number 9.
Stock market could hit an all-time high again. 22,000 today was 18,000 only 6 months ago on Election Day. Mainstream media seldom mentions.
First of all, we are sitting right here. But second, and more to the point, we asked our Friday regular Lee Gallagher of Fortune magazine to weigh in.
As we all know, Trump's use of Twitter is unprecedented, and he's been especially vocal in tweets about the stock market, consistent in pointing out that the strong performance, until the recent stretch of volatility, of course, is largely due to him. You know, from the beginning, the word tweet almost belies how serious these statements are and their impact. These are presidential statements. Another very interesting thing that he started doing was targeting specific companies. Never before has a CEO of a major corporation had to worry about an attack tweet from the president, but we saw it with Lockheed Martin, with GM. This has sort of been another kind of signature element of the Trump presidency and really a brave new world.
Also, Harley Davidson, if you're keeping track. Boeing, Lee Gallagher there from Fortune magazine. Trumpian economic moment number 10, and it's kind of my favorite, came before the president was actually even the president. Back in May of 2016, Mr. Trump was asked on CNBC whether, given his multiple corporate bankruptcies, he felt the United States was obligated to pay all of its debts 100 cents on the dollar. Here you go.
I've done very well with debt. Now, of course, I was swashbuckling, and it did well for me, and it was good for me and all that. And you know, debt was sort of always interesting to me. Now, we're in a different situation with the country, but I would borrow knowing that if the economy crashed, you could make a deal. And if the economy was good, it was good. So, therefore, you can't lose. It's like, you know, you make a deal before you go into a poker game.
Actually, it's not like a poker game. American debt is literally the global standard, and while he did kind of walk himself back, the whole episode was a pretty good early peek inside the economic mind of Donald Trump. All right, so there it is. That's 10 times the president has tried to change the economic conversation in this country. I am sure you've got your own favorites we didn't think of. Tweet them at me. I'm at Kai Rizdahl. The program is at Marketplace. We've got the whole list online as well, marketplace.org. Government data, the through line of the program today, is incredibly important. Not incredibly sexy, but incredibly important. Here are just a couple of the reports released regularly, that is, under normal non-shutdown circumstances, by the U.S. Department of Agriculture. Peanut prices, rice stocks, cotton ginnings, grain cushings, and co-products production, whatever that is. Turkey hatchery. That, by the way, includes the number of turkey eggs in incubators on the first day of the month. Also, World Agricultural Supply and Demand Estimates, WASDE for short. It's basically a balance sheet that the government keeps about the global market for things like wheat and sugar and dairy, a bunch of stuff. As Ryan Wagner knows, he's our soybean and wheat farmer in North Dakota. It was due out, the most recent report, on January 11th.
Right now, everybody's working on the old set of data from December, from the last time we got the report, plus some assumptions that they thought might have been changed on that January report going forward. So it's a little bit fuzzy right now, but hopefully we'll get some clarity on that in the future.
All of that backlog data, information that farmers use to figure out stuff like pricing or how much seed they ought to order so they can figure out how much planting to do come springtime, it is going to come. We just don't know when. Coming up.
For many of us, the federal government was, you know, kind of like the bank of dad.
Come on, who doesn't love a good dad joke, huh? First, though, let's do the numbers. The Dow Industrial's up 183 on this Friday, 0.7%, 24,737. The NASDAQ up 91 points, 1.2%, finished at 71.64. The S&P 500 up 22 points, 0.8%, 26.64. For the week, the Dow added less than 0.1%. The NASDAQ inched up about 0.1%. The S&P 500, however, down, went the other way, 0.2%. Starbucks frothed up 3.6%. The coffee chain posted better than expected revenue and growth in the fourth quarter, also issued a positive outlook for the year ahead. Dunkin', the firm known for donuts and coffee, even though it doesn't want to say it, cooled 2.5%. Bonds fell, yields rose 2.75%. You're listening to Marketplace. Hey, everybody, it's Kai. Look, I want you to listen to the new episode of Make Me Smart. It's our podcast about tech, economics, and culture. This week, we're talking about that whole education to jobs pipeline thing. More students are going to college than ever before, but student debt in this country is up to $1.3 trillion. And it does kind of make you want to ask, is college the best path for a leg up in this economy? Make Me Smart. Find us on Apple Podcasts or wherever you choose to get your podcasts. This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Ryssdal. There's a big economics conference that happens every year. Actual economists, people covering economics and the economy, everybody who's anybody is there. There's networking, academic papers, job interviews as well. But, writes Heather Long, she's an economics correspondent for The Washington Post, it is not an especially welcoming place for female economists. Heather, it's good to talk to you.
Hi, Kai.
Give me the lay of the land, would you, for the American Economics Association meeting. It's the thing to go to if you're an economist in this country.
It is. I sometimes try to compare it to the Super Bowl or the Oscars of the economics world. It's 13,000 economists gather for one weekend of crazy networking, research sharing, and yes, some drinking. And they pick different cities around the country. This year, it was Atlanta. And they always do it the first weekend in January. Right. So I guess they like to keep that New Year's Eve party going.
Right. Those fun economists. But look, on a more serious note, your piece in the Post the other day was kind of extraordinary because it lays out a profession, really, and an institution, this conference, that is deeply, deeply troubled in matters relating to Me Too and equality and harassment.
That's right. I didn't go there expecting to write about this topic. I will say Alice Wu's name comes up a lot, a PhD student now at Harvard, who had done an analysis of a job forum where she scanned a million posts and looked for the types of words people were writing about male versus female PhD candidates who were looking for jobs. And for women, the top 10 words for women were all things about their body, about their appearance, their looks, whether or not they had been pregnant yet. That really opened this Me Too discussion this year in Atlanta, where people wanted to bring this front and center and say, this is a problem, this is wrong. And so I was encouraged by that part.
Yeah. The amazing part, though, is there is all this data you talk about, and yet at this conference, there are job interviews happening in hotel suites where there are applicants sitting on beds, which just you read that and you wince. And there are panels where co-authors of paper who are women are not on the panels, they're in the audience keeping track of how much time the male presenter is using. I mean, it's amazing.
I started walking around this conference for 3 days, and all of these very unfortunate and seemingly minor sexist moments were happening. So the hotel suites are actually an improvement. A big problem in economics is that they still interview people in hotel bedrooms. And I've received a lot of emails about this, these horror stories of sometimes job candidates are sitting on the bed. Sometimes the bed was unmade. Sometimes, you know, there's like dirty towels around or the TV's still been on and people are like half watching a football game. It's clearly not the right setup.
Give me your anecdote about the economist you talked to. You were interested in his research, and he gave you an answer. I'll let you tell the story.
I had a couple of experiences. One, I'd actually sat through the presentation, the hour-long or so presentation, and I went up to the scholar afterwards who was male and said, wow, that was really great. How can I get a copy of that paper? I might want to write about it. And he gave me his card and said, well, go to my website and there's a less mathy version. And again, I had just sat through the presentation. And it just so happened that a male journalist came up right after me and asked almost the same question. And this same male professor said to the male journalist, well, you can get the full paper on my website when you can also get a version for a more general audience. It's all these just little swipes where these subtle differences of the way that men and women are treated in the economics profession.
So if economics now as a profession is woke, as it were, and you've got the incoming president of the AEA, Janet Yellen, as you point out, one of the most famous economists in the world, saying that this is appalling and unacceptable, is there change on the horizon?
I'm encouraged. I have to say, one of the people who I describe in this piece, this that I wrote, actually reached out to me. And he said, I think you were talking about me there. And I didn't actually realize that I had worded differently to the female versus the male journalists. And I'm really sorry that I did that. And I think there's a real commitment to trying to make change. And I think the future of the profession, if it's like that, is very strong.
Heather Long is the economics correspondent at The Washington Post. We got her on Skype. Heather, thanks a lot. I appreciate your time.
Thanks, Kai.
One more item now from my list of, oh, look, data the government usually collects and makes available but didn't during the shutdown. It's imports of steel products. Marketplace's Justin Ho explains why the absence matters.
Steel import data lets us know how much steel we're buying from other countries. And that's important since steel's been such a hot-button issue in the ongoing trade war. The U.S. imposed 25% steel tariffs on a number of countries back in March. And while the most recent report said steel imports were down from a year ago, the U.S. is still the biggest importer of steel in the world. That number, steel imports, also sheds light on how imports compare to the steel we make here. Last year, the U.S. imported 30% of the steel it needed. That's up slightly from a decade ago, but that figures only through the end of October. That's the last report we've seen. Analysts and policymakers will want that missing data as the trade dispute continues.
Marketplace's Justin Ho on the economic unknowns the past 35 days. We have got more, by the way, about the problems with missing government data at marketplace.org. Yeah, there's a deal, but it is still going to be a hot minute before the government gets back up to speed, before checks for back pay get to federal workers, and before the cities and the towns and the millions of people affected by the events of the past 35 days can really assess the damage. One thing is already pretty clear, though. For cities and communities that have looked to the federal government as a dependable partner, there's going to be some serious relationship rethinking going on. Marketplace's Kimberly Adams has that one.
For Atlanta Mayor Keisha Lance Bottoms, news of the shutdown deal comes just in time. Atlanta is set to host the Super Bowl next weekend, and Lance Bottoms has been scrambling, trying to make sure there would be enough TSA workers at the Atlanta airport after the big game.
And it's nothing that can ruin an experience more than having a bad experience when you're trying to get back home and trying to get through an airport.
I met Lance Bottoms earlier this week at the winter meeting of the U.S. Conference of Mayors here in D.C.
We've never had to think about how do we fill the gap for federal workers at our airport. These are things that we will now have to think about in a very real way.
John Giles is the mayor of Mesa, Arizona. He says when the federal government doesn't come through,
we are the stopgap and the safety net in our community.
For instance, Mesa runs the local utility company, and because federal workers have had trouble paying their bills, the utility has brought in less revenue to help pay for city services.
We have reserves, unlike the federal government. Local government, you know, we don't print our own money, and so we have rainy day funds, and we have planned for catastrophes, man-made and otherwise.
I heard that a lot from mayors, comparisons between the shutdown and a natural disaster. And like a hurricane or a tornado, it's been tough to calculate the cost.
In general, we think it's going to be negative for state and local government budgets, and then it's a question of how negative it will be.
Kim Rubin is a senior fellow with the Urban Institute. She says federal workers will eventually be paid. That will cover delayed state and local income taxes. But some revenue, it's just gone, like income and payroll taxes for government contractors who won't get back pay. And on top of that, says Rubin,
we're probably going to see sales tax revenues go down because people are not buying things right now. And then they're also probably going to be more reluctant to buy things after this is over.
But the real lasting effect of the shutdown, especially for local communities, says Rubin, will be in how they see their relationship to the federal government.
What I hear from state and local officials is often not that the economy is affecting what their budgeting and forecasting is. It's the uncertainty about what the federal government is or is not doing.
That's certainly been a takeaway for Atlanta Mayor Keisha Lance Bottoms.
This is a very big reminder of how we have to be able to see about ourselves.
She says preparations for shutdowns will now become part of the city's resiliency plans, and Atlanta won't be the only one.
For many of us, the federal government was, you know, kind of like the bank of dad.
That's Mesa, Arizona Mayor John Giles again.
You know, we always knew that if times got tough, there's an ultimate parent, you know, that has resources. And I think we've all learned that we've got to have a plan B and a plan C in place.
Because given the state of affairs here in D.C., mayors are going to need them. In Washington, I'm Kimberly Adams for Marketplace.
This final note on the way out today, a voice memo that we got from one very attentive Marketplace listener.
This is Kevin Arney in Henry County, Georgia. Kai, I like Marketplace very much and listen whenever I can. However, as a trombonist, I must tell you that the recording of Stormy Weather you refer to as wah-wah trombones is actually more of a trombone sliding between notes as opposed to a trombone using a wah-wah mute. Could you please refer to it as a sliding or slipping or perhaps note-bending trombone? Thank you.
I needed a little clarity on what Mr. Arnie was talking about, so we called him back.
This is a wah-wah trombone. Whereas on the recording you refer to, the trombonist is actually bending the notes by using the slide like this. On behalf of trombonists everywhere, thank you.
No, Mr. Arnie, thank you, sir. All right, we got to go. On a Friday, the Dow Industrials up 183, the NASDAQ up 91 points, S&P 500 up 22 points. That's, you know, 7, 8, 2/10 across the board. Not such a terrible day. Our theme music was composed by BJ Lederman. Marketplace's executive producer is Nancy Fargali. Our executive editor is Evelyn LaRubia. Deborah Clark is the senior vice president and general manager. I'm Kai Rizdal. We are back on Monday. Everybody have yourselves a good weekend, all right? This is APM.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.